its current state on WKAR. Thank you for joining us. Michigan author Steve Luxenberg has written about a compelling real-life family secret in his book Annie's Ghosts, and we visit with Steve later this hour. I think you're going to enjoy that segment. And the last, I have a little bit of history here, the last ever hanging under Michigan law took place on this date in 1830. We look back at that very public incident and explore the state's collective attitude toward capital punishment with author Professor David Chartavoine, also coming up later this hour on Current State. We hope you can stay close. Exporting is big business here in Michigan, and no country is more crucial than our neighbor to the north, Canada. According to Commerce Department estimates, the state of Michigan's merchandise exports to Canada last year reached $25.4 billion. That's nearly 45% of the state's total. With nearly one-third of Michigan manufacturing jobs dependent on exports, Canada is a major player in our state's economic recovery. Here with us now to discuss Canada's trade relationship with Michigan, as well as to offer an update on the status of the new international trade crossing, we welcome Roy Norton, Canada's Consul General based in Detroit. Welcome to the program, Consul General Norton.
Mr. Bashar, good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Governor Snyder has stressed the importance of increased business ties with Canada. What's working right now as you see it between Canada and Michigan? It seems as if quite a few things are working.
Well, trade is growing. It's growing quite rapidly. In fact, over the last two or three years since the governor's been in office, it's grown by 50% or more. And we're encouraged by that, and I think all Michiganders should be encouraged by it, too. We are by far, Canada is, in fact, Ontario is by far Michigan's best market. More than a third of everything that Michigan sells to the world is bought in the province of Ontario, and more than 40% is bought in Canada.
Remind us what accounts for such a spike in activity. You say 50% or possibly more.
Well, part of it is obviously the revival of the automotive sector. It was in a grievous downturn before the governor came to office, and it's come back nicely. And we're both very strong in automotive. We produce comparable numbers of cars, but in fact, more than 60% of the major content, powertrain, for example, of a car that comes off the assembly line in Ontario, is U.S. content. We're fully integrated. It's almost impossible to slap a label on anything that that's produced in either jurisdiction and say that it's American or Canadian. It's both.
Are there other strengths here in Michigan, with Michigan as a trading partner, that you can point to?
Sure, in the agricultural sector. Back when the bridge battle was being fought last fall over Proposition 6, the Michigan Farm Bureau was a big, big supporter of the new bridge because they pointed out that more than a fifth of everything growing on Michigan farms is sold to Canada. And in fact, 68% of Michigan's agricultural exports to the world are bought in Canada.
And is there room for growth there? And if so, where is that room for growth as you see it?
Sure. We're eternal optimists. We look at the numbers and we see constant growth, and we think that building on strengths is the way to go. And that's what the organizers of this conference taking place next week, the Binational Blue Water Regional Collaboration Conference in Port Huron, believe in, that when you have something that's working, build on it, find ways to strengthen it and grow it. And folks from both sides of the border are coming. It's a very balanced conference with experts from Michigan and from Canada. And they're going to talk about ways in which to take advantage of the geographic proximity that we enjoy, cement the transportation and infrastructure links that we've got. There's lots of scope for logistics growth in that sector, especially once the new bridge gets built and maybe a new railway tunnel between Michigan and Canada as well, an additional double-stack rail tunnel to complement the one that's already at Sarnia, Port Huron. So we're very optimistic.
You did refer to this conference next week in Port Huron. This is a first ever binational conference with Michigan and Ontario business and economic policy leaders. It sounds like infrastructure, the way you just answered your last question, it sounds as if infrastructure is a real linchpin for growing the ties, expanding the ties between our two countries. Would I be right in that assessment?
You absolutely would be right. Clearly, all of this product has to move. And if it's at risk because it can't potentially move, then that's going to constrain not only absolute trade, but the potential for growth in trade, which is one of the reasons why the new international trade crossing is so important. I'm sure you're aware that a quarter of all U.S.-Canada trade crosses the 84-year-old Ambassador Bridge, which has been doing yeoman service and which we hope will continue to exist for a while, long into the future, ideally. But it's showing its signs of age, and it would be catastrophic if there were no reliable capacity in place between Michigan and Canada at Detroit-Windsor going forward. So it's why we've placed such a high priority on it. It's why the governor has placed such a high priority on it. It's why Michiganders, I think, voted so overwhelmingly last fall on Proposition 6, and the presidential permit has been issued. And all we need now for the project to go ahead is for the U.S. federal government to signal its willingness and its capacity to fund the U.S. Customs Plaza. And once that's in place, the whole project can roll forward and create lots of short-term employment. I mean, many thousands of jobs in the construction sector. But beyond that, the key factor really is the confidence that it will offer to businesses that want to locate in this region on either side of the border, but who need reliable transportation capacity in order to have the comfort to do so.
Remind us, please, Consul General Roy Norton of Canada is our guest here this morning on Current State. Remind our listeners of the financing piece that is being picked up by your country in the financing of the international trade, the new international trade crossing.
Happy to, because this, of course, was an issue of some distortion last year. Canada is paying 15/16ths of the cost of the project. The state of Michigan pays nothing, and the remaining 16th is the responsibility of the U.S. federal government. That's the Customs Plaza, which we hope will be clarified soon. I was just at a conference this past weekend in Kansas City of the U.S. Council of State Governments, where the 50 states voted unanimously a resolution calling on the U.S. government to proceed quickly to fund the Customs Plaza, because this is a project of vast importance, not just to Michigan, but frankly to the entire Midwest and the Southeast as well.
Back to next week's conference here. Have there been enough of these kinds of gatherings in the past?
Oh, probably not, but it's wise people at Michigan State University and at the St. Clair County Economic Development Alliance and at the I-69 International Trade Corridor who recognize that deficiency and who are doing something about it. We are one another's greatest advantages, Canada and Michigan, Ontario and Michigan, and we need to fully exercise the opportunity that associates with that. We need to stop doing some things. I wrote an article in Dome Magazine, the public policy journal in Michigan, that was just published a couple weeks ago, talking about an issue called country of origin labeling in the agricultural sector, where certain protectionist behavior by the U.S. National government risks causing a mini trade war, which we think would be foolish, but frankly, we may be left with no choice but to take retaliation. I noticed yesterday that a bill has been introduced in the Michigan Senate that would extend preferences on government procurement to Michigan firms. Well, just last June at Mackinac, at the Council of Great Lakes Governors, a resolution was passed by all of the governors saying that this was not the way to go, that building the region, recognizing the links, the cross links among us and between us, is the way to maximize the benefit for everybody. So there's certain behaviors that we need to stop. And
Canada does not practice country of origin labeling then?
No.
Okay.
We don't.
Okay.
And we no longer provide procurement preferences at the provincial level for local or provincial business and industry because we recognize the importance of open markets. So conferences like this will allow for discussion of this sort of thing, and it'll surface issues. It'll allow people to become more cognizant of the downsides of certain initiatives, and hopefully will mobilize people in favor of always having a thumb on the scale in favor of regional growth, of trade back and forth, of eliminating barriers, of promoting connections, and of not doing things that would cause us to withdraw into cocoons and leave jobs on the table.
So you're saying, in so many words, just this is for all of our amateur economists listening, you're saying that the country of origin labeling basically constitutes some kind of protectionist measure, and that Canada really falls philosophically on the other side of that argument toward a more free trade approach.
Well, it's already been judged so by the World Trade Organization,
right. Okay.
which found the U.S. government guilty in 2011, and when you appealed, it upheld the original verdict. So it's incumbent on the U.S. to take action to fix the problem, and we're hoping that Congress will do that legislatively, perhaps in the context of the Farm Bill that's being debated right now.
We've established a foreign trade zone here in Lansing, just like Detroit and Grand Rapids. What role does a foreign trade zone play in facilitating trade between the United States and Canada? We have about a minute to.
Yeah, well, we have some too, and they have potential great contribution to make. They certainly agglomerate business and industry. They promote an awareness of the virtues of trade, and they accentuate, I think, the importance of the logistical connections between our two countries, because if those don't exist, the foreign trade zones aren't going to prosper.
How have Canada and the United States together improved or enhanced border security since 9/11?
Well, we've done a lot. It's a little bit tougher to get across the border, but a lot of work is being done to improve that. The President and the Prime Minister in December of 2011 launched something they called the Beyond the Border Action Plan, which deals both with security and regulation, and the objective is to make the borders just as efficient as we possibly can. A lot of technology, a lot of information sharing, and it seems to be working, and a lot of harmonization or alignment of regulations as well, so that you don't end up with unnecessary and prolonged delays at the border as a result of products having to be unloaded from trucks and scrutinized unnecessarily.
A really good discussion. Roy Norton is Canada's Consul General based in Detroit. Mr. Norton, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Bayshore, very much. I enjoyed it. Take care. Bye.
Consul General Norton will be giving the keynote address at the first Binational Trade Conference between Michigan and Ontario businesses of the Blue Water region next week in Port Huron, Michigan. The conference is sponsored in part by the U.S. Economic Development Administration, the Canadian Consulate General, and MSU's Center for Community and Economic Development. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. On this day, 183 years ago, thousands of people gathered to watch the second and last execution in Michigan under state law. Stephen Simmons was sentenced to death for the murder of his wife. From this case, eventually came the end of capital punishment in the state. Michigan was the first English-speaking jurisdiction in the world to do away with capital punishment. David G. Chardevoine is a law professor and the author of the book A Hanging in Detroit, Stephen Gifford Simmons and the Last Execution Under Michigan Law. He explained that Simmons was not a well-liked man.
Well, he was not a very nice man. He had been a soldier for a while, but he was kicked out of the army. He had tried farming very unsuccessfully, and he came to Michigan about 1825, bought a tavern, which according to all reports was a very horrible tavern, and pretty much drank most of the time.
And he ended up killing his wife in a drunken rage, ended up being tried for murder. What was the court system like in Michigan when Simmons was tried?
Well, we're during the territorial period here, and there was a territorial Supreme Court of three judges who also served as Wayne County Circuit Court. So they tried the case, the three of them, as the circuit court. Any appeal would have gone to them as the Supreme Court.
At the time, others committed murder, yet Simmons was only the second person under law in Michigan to receive the death sentence. Why was Simmons sentenced to hang?
I believe because he killed his wife, rather than a friend or a brother. Two other men were in jail at the same time he was. One had killed his friend, one had killed his brother in drunken rages. One got 1 year, one got 3 years. They were found guilty of manslaughter rather than murder.
What was the more typical punishment doled out for crimes similar to Simmons at the time then?
Well, if it was murder, it was always going to be death, but juries were very reluctant to return murder verdicts. They preferred to find them guilty of manslaughter, which would be a relatively short period. Michigan did not have a jail that would where someone could live for years and years, and so the penalties tended to be rather short.
What was Michigan, particularly Detroit, like when Simmons was sentenced? Was it still a backwoods frontier, or was it becoming more established?
It was becoming more established. The opening of the Erie Canal in 1825 changed the state tremendously. Thousands and thousands of people came from, mostly from western New York, to Michigan on the Erie Canal, took steamboats from Buffalo to Detroit, and the state was growing. Detroit at that time had only just over 2,000 residents, and the three-county area, Wayne, Macomb, and Oakland, only had about 18,000. But people were settling out towards Lansing, across the southern part of the Lower Peninsula, so it was becoming more of a mercantile state, whereas before it had mostly been a place where Native Americans traded their furs.
There are a lot of stories and myths floating around about the day Stephen Simmons was executed, giant crowds gathering, Simmons apparently singing hymns before he hanged. What really happened that day?
Well, there was a large crowd for that time. It was about 2,000 people. People came in from around the surrounding area, slept overnight out by the where the scaffold had been set up. But the stories that he sang seem rather dubious to me, because nothing that was contemporary ever spoke about that. In fact, the two or three accounts that we have don't mention him singing at all. So I think that this is something that was sort of invented in the 1870s or 1880s by a gentleman who was giving a speech to the Historical Society on a totally unrelated subject, and all of a sudden veered into this story about Stephen Simmons and the singing the hymn. And I think that's where it came from, and that's where it sort of stayed as a myth. But the people who were there really never talked about it.
In many accounts of the hanging, it said that there was a great sense of regret or remorse. Was that remorse for Simmons, or was it for what he did?
I think there was remorse that what they had come to see was entertainment that they didn't get. Yes, there was a band there. Yes, there were grandstands set up to watch it. The people didn't get the thrill that they wanted. Instead, they walked away feeling kind of hollow.
And did this event end up spurring an aversion to the death penalty in Michigan, in your view?
Well, in my view, there had already been an aversion, just by the fact that there had not been one since 1821. And there was never another, even though the death penalty theoretically was on the books until 1847, another 17 years. But I think, yes, it started it, although certainly nobody at the time spoke out against capital punishment before his execution. The next January, Governor Cass remarked that he would have preferred to have had the power to commute his sentence to life imprisonment, but in fact the law did not allow him to do that.
Simmons' hanging was the last legal death sentence in Michigan. For almost two centuries since that, Michigan has kept the death penalty out of law. Now, it may not be because of Simmons, but what about the politics or culture in Michigan that has kept the death penalty out of the books?
Well, what kept it out, I'm not really sure. I think what started it in the first place was it's the nature of the people who came to Michigan. They were mostly came from Western New York, but they were mostly of New England stock. They were tended to be people who were a little more adventurous, and psychologists tell me that those people tend to be more against the death penalty, marginally. It was not an overwhelming feeling. It took quite a few years to get the death penalty set aside in the legislature. Since then, though, it seems to have agreed with a majority of people. Every once in a while, there's an effort to change it back to the death penalty, but it usually fails. I mean, it has always failed up till now.
What do you make of those? I mean, whenever there is a murder that people can't make sense of or is particularly heinous, we often hear cries for the reinstatement. What do you make of those?
Well, I think people have a feeling of a need for something when a very bad murder takes place. They may feel that somehow they didn't stop it, that they should have done something, even though it would have been impossible for them to do something. So they think about getting revenge. And actually, these days, most people don't believe that executions deter crime. Most of them think of it more as revenge. Now that we have the prohibition on the death penalty in our Constitution since 1963, and this is 50 years later now, it's become very difficult to overturn the prohibition on executions. But I think overall, there simply has never been a truly popular movement to reinstate the death penalty. There have been people who have been in favor of it and against it, but overall, I think most of the people in the state have been more or less satisfied with the way things are.
But as recently as the 1930s, there was a federal execution that took place in the state of Michigan. How does that factor into this longer historical discussion?
Well, yes, Mr. Shepetoris was trying to rob a bank in Midland, and he shot a bystander who he thought erroneously was a policeman. He was tried under a federal statute for committing a murder during a bank robbery of a federal bank. And he was convicted in the Bay City Federal Court, and he was executed at Milan. The interesting thing is that Governor Frank Murphy, who was the governor of Michigan at that time, begged Franklin Roosevelt to please move the execution out of Michigan. And in fact, the president would have done so, but the judge, Judge Tuttle, refused to do so. He said that it would be not a good thing to give this onerous duty to one of our neighbors. And so the execution did take place at Milan. There was a tremendous uproar against it, and I think that showed that even at that time, when crime was much greater than it is today, when bank robberies were going on, while a lot of other crime was going on, the people of Michigan were still strong against capital punishment.
A few years ago, a historical marker was placed where Stephen Simmons' tavern once stood. Why do you think it's important to remember this event?
Well, I think for the very reason that it was the last. It was a very, very bad case in that he beat his much smaller wife to death while he was drunk, while she was drunk. And from that, though, from that very, very bad case, eventually came the end of capital punishment. And I think that is one of the things that makes Michigan unique. We were the first English-speaking jurisdiction in the world to do away with capital punishment.
David G. Chardevoine is an attorney, author, and professor based in Farmington Hills, Michigan. Mr. Chardevoine, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Water attracted early settlers to Detroit, and water fueled its growth. Now it's an important asset to the city's recovery. Today, Current State continues to explore Detroit's waterfront, challenges, and opportunities in our series, Detroit's Water Renaissance. So far, we've looked at lucrative walleye fishing on the Detroit River, daylighting streams, rebuilding shorelines, and the destruction of the Rouge River. When a river is as heavily polluted as Detroit's Rouge, it's hard to imagine how it could ever be cleaned up. We heard last week that the Rouge is one of the most polluted rivers in the Great Lakes. Yet there is a plan to, if not restore the Rouge to its pre-industrial state, at least bring the river back to better health. As independent producer Karen Schaefer reports, it'll take a lot of time, money, and cooperation between government, nonprofit groups, and industry to get the job done. But some of that work is already underway.
When it started production in 1928, the titanic Ford Rouge complex along the Rouge River, the world's largest integrated factory, had everything needed to turn raw materials into automobiles. The Rouge was not just one factory, but many, from steel mills and blast furnaces to a huge power plant, rail lines, and riverside docks. And it produced a lot of pollution. But today's Ford Motor Company is trying to turn around its dirty legacy.
Welcome to the Ford Rouge Center. I hope you enjoy your day here. You ought to have a great time watching the new F-150 being built and seeing the most environmentally advanced plant in the world.
Ford Rouge features a new kind of assembly plant with very little pollution, not even packaging waste. The $2 billion Dearborn truck factory, still Ford's largest, opened in 2004 and employs about 6,000 workers, making 1,200 trucks a day. To illustrate what's different about this factory, tour guide Bob Simmons takes us up to the roof.
This is our roof.
Oh my gosh.
This is the largest living roof in the world. It's 10.4 acres. It's enough area that you could actually design a 9-hole golf course on it.
We're looking out at a vast flat roof covered in low-growing plants. The living roof is just one part of a stormwater storage system that includes porous paving and wetlands designed to reduce runoff to the Rouge.
It has lots of other advantages too. It insulates the plant, makes about a 10-degree difference summer and winter.
Other green innovations include rooftop skylights that bring in daylight and reduce electricity. Outdoors, plants, not bulldozers, remove toxins from the soils of this former brownfield. And on the assembly line, it's clean, nearly odor-free, and a lot quieter than you'd expect.
There's a bank swallow colony right here. See where they burrow their holes in just below the dirt line there.
Downstream from the Ford Rouge factories, Detroit riverkeeper Robert Burns, who works for the Detroit chapter of a national nonprofit that monitors threatened rivers, points out signs that the Rouge is returning to life. Spawning carp leap out of the water, and great blue herons stalk the shallows near the overgrown concrete shoreline. Burns says industry, once part of the problem, has become part of the solution.
I came out here with the environmental person from U.S. Steel, and we drilled some more holes in there to create some more nesting sites for them. So that's kind of the small things that we do. We work with DT Energy and U.S. Steel, and they've got a little more environmental focus now, and they've done quite a bit of work.
But one cleaner factory and more concerted environmental efforts by others can't alone solve the array of pollution challenges facing the Rouge. One of the most costly problems has been reducing overflows of sewage from the densely populated watershed. Jennifer Tewksbury is with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. She says over the last 30 years, Detroit and other communities have spent more than $2 billion on solutions like building huge basins to retain stormwater so it doesn't spill over into combined sanitary sewers during heavy rains and dump raw sewage into the river.
Each plant, they've been looking at their systems, they've been upgrading. I think at one point there were 168 combined sewer overflows within the watershed, which means when it rained, everything came out. Now we're down to, I think Detroit has 28 left that they need to repair.
Reducing air pollution in Rouge communities is the focus of Southwest Detroit Environmental Vision. At Riverside Park, near the Ambassador Bridge to Canada, diesel pollution from idling trucks is a major concern. Executive Director Kathy Stott says with funding from the EPA, her group has helped local truck fleets, even riverboats, convert to cleaner fuels.
If you look to the east, there is the J.W. Westcott mail boat that services the freighters that come through the Detroit River. We've also installed pollution controls on more than 150 trucks. We have replaced 17 trucks and 2 school buses in the neighborhood.
Other groups are addressing issues like trash pickup and flooding. Friends of the Rouge holds annual river cleanup events with thousands of volunteers. And the Alliance of Rouge Communities is educating homeowners about simple practices to reduce runoff, like building rain gardens. Jennifer Tewksbury of the Michigan DEQ says the combination of all these efforts is making progress toward completing a 20-year plan to make the Rouge a healthier river. But there's still at least one project with a big price tag, removing the toxic sediments that still contaminate Rouge fish.
Just to do the feasibility study, we're looking at $1 million to look and see how much it's going to cost to do the actual work. The old channel, you know, $3-4 million, easy.
Tewksbury hopes that money will come from the Federal Great Lakes Legacy Act. That funding is set to expire in 2014, although congressional reauthorization is already underway. The same legislation would also continue funding for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which Tewksbury says can be used for other Rouge projects, like restoring habitat. And that funding is crucial. While greening a large roof, drilling some swallow holes, and buying a few new buses all help, without removing the contaminated sediments, restoration of the Rouge will be incomplete. Advocate Kathy Stott grew up in Southwest Detroit and has no plans to leave.
I love this community. I enjoy the camaraderie of all my friends, all the community organizations, all the business owners, all the people, the people that fight alongside of us, you know, in all of our endeavors. You know, it is truly home.
Stott may sound a little uncertain, and she has good reason to be. A lot still has to be done. But there's one thing she's sure of, that making the Rouge River a cleaner, healthier place is worth the effort. For WKAR and Great Lakes Echo, I'm Karen Schaefer in Detroit.
This story was produced by Current State and Great Lakes Echo with support from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. This is the conclusion of our Detroit Water Renaissance series. If you missed any of the other stories in this series, you can find them online at wkar.org or greatlakesecho.org. Also today, we launched the start of our segment, Great Lakes Month in Review. We'll take time each month to recap environmental news from around the Great Lakes Basin with Chicago-based journalist and commentator Gary Wilson. Gary, glad to have you back.
Hey, Mark. Good morning. Always good to be with you and the people in mid-Michigan. And before we get started, great segment on the Rouge. That's my old stomping grounds.
Oh, you're familiar with the Rouge then.
Right. Grew up just a mile or two from the Detroit River and familiar with the Rouge and the Detroit River. And glad to see you guys giving it some due.
Great. Well, you and I spoke recently about Great Lakes Week and the conference that was associated with Great Lakes Week. Let's start there. In retrospect, what were some of the bigger takeaways from the conference?
Well, Mark, there were really two, and I've got a third one, something I call beneath the radar, but the two big takeaways were, first, regarding algae blooms in Lake Erie. The International Joint Commission, that's the U.S.-Canada agency that advises the two governments on not only Great Lakes issues, but all transporter water issues. They came out with their report called the Lake Erie Ecosystem Priority Report that provides a recommended remedy for the algae blooms, primarily in Lake Erie, because this report was born out of the terrible blooms that occurred in 2011, record algae blooms. But a lot of the information applies to, you know, the whole Great Lakes Basin. And this report was long anticipated. And one of the big takeaways for me was how the commission, which is really a diplomatic agency, it's housed in the State Departments of both governments, They used, you know, pretty much unvarnished language in their recommendation. That's a little bit uncharacteristic. Like I said, being a diplomatic agency, they tend to use softer language because they don't want to offend people. But they really came right out, and they used quite direct language. And I happened to be talking to one of the commissioners in Milwaukee, and I commented on that. And she told me that the report went through a number of drafts, and at each level, they typed it up and strengthened the language quite a bit. So I see this as a good thing.
Does that then reflect a growing consensus that algae blooms are a bigger problem and need to be addressed more vigorously?
Absolutely. Algae blooms are a very serious problem, not only in the Great Lakes, but other areas around the country. And this 2011 event really got people's attention. And I know Lana Pollack, who is the U.S. chair for the Joint Commission, she personally took an interest in it. And she's been at the IJAC for about 3 years now. And, I think that, and she's known very well in Michigan, and she's known to not hold back in her language a little bit, professional but direct. I thought she got a little bit of a slow start with the IJC, but I can see her signature over these recommendations. They're sort of no holds barred.
Did the commission make particular recommendations then? Can you go any deeper with us on that?
Sure, Mark. I'd love to. They recommend banning fertilizer, and this is almost all applies to farmers. Banning fertilizer on frozen ground. It's long been a practice to apply fertilizer to frozen ground, but the net is most of it runs off. So that was one of their number one priorities.
Hmm.
They also recommend the increased use of regulations. There's that word that nobody likes, regulations, versus voluntary measures. In recent years, voluntary measures have been the watchword, encouraging farmers to kind of monitor themselves and use best practices. Nice stuff, but it's not working. And then they had a very specific recommendation regarding the amount of phosphorus that should be permitted to run off from the Maumee River. That's about 40%, and 70% and to be reduced by 70% in certain higher areas. Those are big numbers, but that's sort of a departure, given setting specific targets. There were a few other things that were kind of, one of them was tied to the farm bill that's, deadlocked in Congress now, so we're not sure what will happen there.
What happens to the recommendations, though? Who will see these recommendations?
The recommendations will go to the two government agencies in the U.S. It's the U.S. EPA, and in Canada, it's the counterpart, Environment Canada, but also to state agencies. And then it's up to them to take it from there. The IJC, while they can prescribe strong medicine, they are an advisory agency, and it's up to the rest of us to take it from there. So we'll see what happens.
I believe Waukesha was also on the agenda at the Great Lakes Week Conference. What finally was resolved with regard to Waukesha, Wisconsin?
No resolution, Mark. They're on the city is on the cusp of submitting its proposal to its state DNR, its final proposal. The big news to come out of the Great Lakes Week Conference related to Waukesha was the city made a presentation to the governors from around the region, sort of a preview of what they might expect. And they reduced the amount of water that they're going to be asking for by close to 1 million gallons. From right around 11 million gallons to down to about 10 million gallons.
And for our listeners, who missed this segment before, we should point out that Waukesha is low on water, and it is made overtures to try to retrieve water for its use, for its municipal use, from the Great Lakes, even though the city lay outside the Great Lakes Basin. We need to provide a little bit of context for the people who missed those previous segments. But continue, please.
Yeah, Mark, that's good. Thank you. I talked to a number of people, during the conference, and they didn't see this as a terribly big event, requesting less water. Waukesha was there on a selling mission. That's what they need to do. They need to get the approval of the other states. So it was a way to make their proposal just a little bit more palatable. And I think they were making I attended the session. I think they were making a sort of a special appeal to Michigan, if I could detect that. Historically, Michigan has been the toughest reviewer of diversion requests, and former Governor Engler was the only governor ever to disapprove of a diversion request under the previous agreement. So a big sales job there by Waukesha, and that'll be set in motion pretty soon.
And I understand hydraulic fracturing or fracking also was a topic at the conference. How did that discussion play out?
Well, I think it's one of the under-the-radar topics, Mark. I had two veteran policy people from Michigan approach me, and they talked about, geez, you guys are covering Waukesha, you know, rightly so, quite a bit, but what about the taking of water via fracking in Michigan? That's been a kind of a beneath-the-radar, and they both pointed out to the proposal in northern Michigan to take 4 billion gallons of water for fracking. And the point that they're making, and I think it's a good one, is that Waukesha's request, they with 10 million gallons a day, they will return about 98% of that to Lake Michigan as treated wastewater. Their point was, with fracking, the 4 billion gallons that comes out of the ground will not be returned. It's out of the streams. It will not be returned. And that's enough water to supply Waukesha for about 440 days, and none of it gets returned to the system. That's their concern. And they also expressed concern about Michigan's water withdrawal assessment tool, whether it can do a good job in actually handling fracking.
Okay.
So more to play out there.
Gary Wilson is a Chicago-based Great Lakes commentator and journalist. You can find more of Gary Wilson's thoughts on the basin at greatlakesecho.org. Gary, thank you for joining us.
Always good to be with you, Mark. Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Family secrets are often the stuff of suspenseful movies and fictional page-turners. Detroit native Steve Luxenberg discovered his family had one of its own, the existence of an aunt who had been shut away in a mental institution. Luxenberg recounts the story in his book, Annie's Ghosts. The novel is this year's Great Michigan Read selection. The program is an initiative of the Michigan Humanities Council, which engages the public in a statewide discussion about the work of a Michigan-born or based author. I sat down with Steve Luxenberg this week to ask him about the hidden tale that prompted him to write the book.
Well, when a story falls in your lap,
you write it.
You write it. At least you write it 5 or 10 years later when you figure out what the hell the story was all about. My mom had a secret. She had a secret sister. And this sister was somebody I never met, never heard of. And my mom was an only child. She told us that frequently. So the idea that she had a sister was not something that fit into the picture I had of my mom and the elaborate stories she told about growing up in Detroit as an only child.
And without asking you to give too much away, why is it Ghosts of Annie in the title?
I can say ghosts on the radio and hiss. No, the reason, I thought if I called it Annie's Ghost, then it would only be about Annie. So Ghost is an attempt, at least, to have us think about all of the ghosts in our own lives, all of the ideas, secrets, stories that haunt all of us.
People today are sensitive to the use of the words like moron, and yet in Annie's era, words like this were routinely used to describe people with mental or developmental challenges. Was it hard to read that stuff in the records?
Well, you know, it's a good place to start, that question you just asked, because it tells you the job of a historian, which is to not imagine you living in the era that you live in, but the era that you're researching.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1910, 1920, the words moron, imbecile, things like that that we find very difficult were in the law. They were legal terms. They were not social terms. They went from the legal language into the common language. And it's a good thing we don't use them anymore, but they were meant to make distinctions between levels of disability. Yes, it was hard to read, but it also was important to not only read it, but to inhabit it, to understand it, to try to live in 1920, 1930, 1940, when this story starts to take place, because otherwise I would be imposing my own judgments on an era that I didn't live in.
By the end of your research about your missing aunt, did you ever feel like you got a very personal sense of who she was?
Not enough, frankly, because while I have records that tell me about the arc of her life in the 31 years that she spent at a hospital called Eloise outside of Detroit, I never felt like I was able to really know what her days were like. Mm. I got glimpses of them because I have a cousin who would take my grandmother, Annie's mother, to visit her. And she saw glimpses of Annie, but these are just glimpses. And so I really don't feel like I ever got to know her. I do know that she had enough insight, even though she had mental illnesses that put her in the hospital, to understand that she was not going to have a normal life. She said that in the records that I have. And so I feel like I got to know her at a surface level, but not at a deep level.
So many Jewish families like yours lost people during the Holocaust. Did it seem especially cruel to you that you essentially lost a family member right here in Michigan in a mental hospital?
It was cruel to my cousin Anna, who happens to have the same name as Annie, so it makes it confusing. But I have a cousin who I never met until about 8 years ago. And she was a Holocaust survivor. When I was growing up and people would ask me if they knew that I was Jewish, they would say, well, did you lose anybody in the Holocaust? I'd say, oh, no, my family all came over before World War I. It never occurred to me that, of course, that I had family members who were there because I didn't know those people. Mm. So I met Anna, who managed to survive the Holocaust, and she thought it was cruel, and she was angry at my mom and told me in no uncertain terms about the anger that she had and the argument that she had with my mom in the 1950s when I was a toddler. But I didn't feel that way. I didn't feel that way, I guess, because I think of this as a book of understanding and not of judgment. I don't feel like it's my place to sit on my mom's shoulder and tell her what she did right and wrong. I think she made the wrong choice for herself because I think her secret was a burden to her. But I don't think the story isn't about me, it's about my mother and Annie.
So you had an aunt you didn't know existed and a cousin you never met.
That's right.
Okay.
Although the cousin said I met her when I was about 2 years old, but we don't know anybody when we're two.
Your book was all about tracking down secrets within your family. When you published the book and exposed all those secrets to a potentially worldwide audience, how did that feel?
I thought a lot about whether I had a right to air the so-called dirty laundry of the family, although I don't really consider that to be an apt term for this. And I felt that if I could help other people understand that secrets, some of which can be good, there are good secrets, and some of which can be bad, to look at their own families, to look at the secrets that they hold, and perhaps release themselves from the pain and suffering of holding in those secrets, then that was a good thing. And my mom would be proud of that. Would she want this story written? Well, that probably isn't what she would have wanted. But I think that, every generation creates new secrets. And so this question of how secrets affect us and what happens, I think this is something that we live with from year to year and time to time.
Do you feel secrets like this have the capacity to wreak havoc into the future?
They didn't in our case, but I do think, and I've seen evidences of wreaking havoc, because when a family member is carrying a burden, sometimes they're behaving in ways that you don't understand. And you can't understand. I did not understand some of my mom's behavior because I didn't understand what was driving her to feel the way that she was feeling. And it made it much harder when she had her own psychiatric episode, when she was in her late 70s, an episode of depression, to work with the psychiatrist, to work with the social worker, because I didn't understand what was driving her, and they didn't understand it. And so I do feel that We should not think of secrets as living and dying in one generation's time. They can roll down through the generation.
Now you're part of the Great Michigan Read. Have you encountered other people who've been inspired to look for relatives that nobody talked about because of reading your book?
Well, the book came out 3 years ago, and I get emails every week from somebody who wants my help in tracking down a relative that they've just learned about. And I give that help to them. My daughter teases me and say I ought to go into business giving that help, but I do it for free. So the Great Michigan Read begins tonight, and it'll be really interesting to see how many people want to share their own secrets. I don't think that that's a requirement when people come to the talk that I'm going to give. That's a personal matter. But there have been other talks that I've given in the state in the last 3 years since the book came out, and frequently people will ask during the Q&A period, they'll share a family story, perhaps a secret, with the audience. And I've certainly had people come up to me afterwards. The most amazing, if I can pick one, the most amazing story was when somebody came up to me with the book in their hand for me to sign, and as they handed it to me, they said, you know, I brought the book to our Thanksgiving dinner, and we have a family secret that we were unable to talk about, and I said, please read this book. It will make you feel safe to talk about that elephant in the room that we cannot talk about. And she said, it worked. Now, what author can ask for a better story than that?
You must feel great about that.
That one story I feel great about. If that's all I have, I'll hold on to it.
Michigan author Steve Luxenberg's book is called Annie's Ghosts. The novel, based on a real-life relative of the author, is this year's Great Michigan Read selection. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we speak with Democratic congressional candidate Pam Burns, a candidate in Michigan's 7th District. Also, we'll look at Iran and U.S. relations. That and more Wednesday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.